You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Today,
it's an amazing feat of experimental physics.
We begin our countdown of the biggest physics stories of 2021.
I think it opens the door to some future work, but it doesn't, in its current form, describe the real world.
With quantum physicist Ian Durham.
I mean, the scary thing is that, you know, eventually we might get to the point where we could read people's thoughts.
I'm Zia Morali. Welcome everyone to the Foundational Questions Institute's annual rundown of the highlights and sometimes lowlights of the year, as chosen by quantum physicist and FQXI member Ian Durham of St. Anselm College in New Hampshire, who joins me now.
Yes. Before we get started, I just want to, we're going to dedicate this episode to Zia's dad, Amir, who was a big fan of this Christmas episode and who passed away in the summer. So this is dedicated to Amir Morali.
Thank you, Ian. It's been another tough year, but here we all are, set with the pre-list, as it were, of highlights that almost, but didn't quite, make 2021's top five.
Our first one came out in March that didn't seem to make too many people's list, but it's a new particle that got discovered at CERN, this collaboration at the LHC and Fermilab. I just like the name, the Odderon, as in odd, as in weird.
Yeah, I loved that name too.
Although actually in this case, odd means odd as in numbers. So the Odderon, it's an elusive three gluon state that was predicted 50 years ago. So you have the four basic forces of nature that we know of. Gravity, electromagnetism, the weak nuclear interaction, and the strong nuclear interaction. And each of them has a messenger particle. And so the messenger particle, which is always a boson, in electromagnetism is the photon. And in the strong nuclear interaction, which is what holds the nucleus together, it's gluons. But then they have these other things that float around deep in quantum chromodynamics that these gluons can also interact between themselves. And in particular, there's this property called color. There are a lot of really strangely named properties in nuclear physics, by the way. So there's, you know, color, strangeness, upness, downness, topness, bottomness, charmedness. The gluons, an odd number of gluons, are able to be colorless, which basically means that they shield the strong interaction. States that have sort of two or three or more gluons are usually called gluballs. They predicted in 1973 this thing called the Odderon, which was a three gluon particle, and they just found it. So there you go.
So you emphasized that this is a three gluon state and it can shield from the strong force. Is there some particular importance to the fact that it does have an odd number of gluons? Does it make it harder to find? It seems to have been named on the basis that it's odd.
I don't think it has a whole lot of significance in the sense of, in theory, you could have glue balls of any number of gluons. And this one happens to have three, which is an odd number. But interestingly enough, so protons and neutrons are each made up of three quarks that are held together with gluons. But then what holds the protons and neutrons together is that the protons and neutrons exchange a meson, which is a quark-antiquark pair. But at very, very high energy, multi-tera electron volt energies, interactions between protons are expected to be mediated purely by gluons. In particular, there was predictions, mathematical predictions on elastic scattering at sort of low momentum transfer but high energy, that they used something called a Pomeran, which, isn't that a dog?
Yeah, it's isn't that a Pomeranian?
Yeah, it's like a Pomeranian. Anyway, a Pomeran, which is a color-neutral virtual glue ball that's made up of an even number of gluons, right? And so that's sort of the traditional picture, is that you have this Pomeran, and I just have this image of a Pomeranian in my head. In 2018, there was a reported measurements at high energies that couldn't really be explained by that picture, which suggested that there might be a three gluon compound or a five gluon compound or something like that that was being exchanged.
And now you've put this image of protons exchanging small fluffy dogs in people's minds. It's not too much of a surprise that that was wrong. But anyway, Pomerons weren't enough, so you needed odorons in theory, and in 2021 they found them. I wonder if this would still have caught your attention, Ian, if the particles didn't have such fun names. Or maybe the names were too much fun, and that's why it hasn't got in the top five.
Well, why did it not make my list? Because it's a composite particle. It was predicted in 1973, even though they just found it. It's not like we found a brand new particle that suggested any new physics, per se, right? This is nothing outside of standard QCD. So it's a really cool result. It's very cool, so much so that when it was announced in March, I flagged it for the top five of the year. But, you know, other amazing things happened, as we will see, and I just thought, it's good. It'll get an honorable mention. And I have to say, it didn't make anybody else's list, even as a possibility. So congratulations to the Odoron crew.
See, now I'm wondering if it's like the Oscars. Like, physicists are holding back their announcements to December, the week before we record the podcast, to try and increase their chances of getting on the list.
That could be true.
Yeah, well, a keen listener will just have to go back to past lists and the orderings and see if there is a bias towards more recent announcements. So when did the next honorable mention come out, Ian?
Okay, so the next one is a much-hyped laser fusion results out of the National Ignition Facility. Basically, they took a big step towards realizing fusion using lasers as a milestone at the National Ignition Facility in California. It's operated by Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. So the reason it makes anybody's list, because this was on other people's lists as well, is that fusion energy is the type of energy that occurs when atoms and molecules and things fuse together. So that's the kind of stuff that happens in the core of stars. And it produces energy. I mean, that's the energy that we live off of, because that's the light from the sun is basically fusion energy that is being beamed down on us, and that's how we live. The theory is that the sun can produce energy doing that, then maybe there's a way we could do it, and maybe that's a way to, you know, I don't know, solve the climate crisis or whatever. We know how to make fissionable energy by, you know, blowing up atomic bombs and things, which is breaking atoms and nuclei apart, but fusing them, you know, we can achieve it under insane pressures and temperatures, but, you know, there's this elusive goal of cold fusion, which I'm not entirely sure we're ever going to reach. And at the NIF, they previously have been able to create energies of about 0.1 megajoules, whereas this particular one on August 8th, they were able to yield 1.3 megajoules. So that's a huge jump over the previous record. The reason it doesn't make my full top five is because it's still not fusion. It's a lot of energy, but it's still not fusion.
Right, okay, yeah. And I guess so, even though they've yielded a huge amount of energy, it's actually still only about 70% of the energy of the lasers that they're delivering into the system.
Correct, right. Because the whole idea is you want to be able to produce more energy than you're using to create it. I mean, that's kind of the point, right? And so my attitude is, I think it's great, wonderful. Call me when you have fusion.
So it's well done for effort, but please try harder and come back next year. So
yes. Right. Again, it still made the list because it's quite an achievement to be able to do this. They operated 192 pulsed laser beams on the inner surface of a centimeter-long cylinder. And inside it, there's a fuel capsule, which is about 2 millimeter diameter hollow sphere that has a sort of thin deuterium-tritium layer. It's an amazing feat of experimental physics. And so, you know, it's worthy of... Let me put it this way. I suspect that if they ever do achieve actual fusion and they get more energy out than they put in, I would not be surprised if that won a Nobel Prize. And my awards are not Nobel Prize level.
Not yet.
Not yet.
But, you know, we're getting there, Ian.
We're getting there.
Maybe if we actually create one of those badges that we've been promising every year, you know, to give to our winners, then possibly we'd overtake the Nobels, because I think people would really want those badges.
We just might.
If we could be bothered.
If we could be bothered, yes.
So who's next on the list of honorable mentions? So among the group of people who haven't quite earned the badges that don't yet exist.
Who's next is, I always have to throw a bunch of mathematicians on here. Actually, there's more math in this year's list than first meets the eye. There were three very, very important papers in mathematical physics that came out this year that worked out the details of what's called Liouville quantum field theory, which is a two-dimensional model of quantum gravity. In 1981, Alexander Polyakov, who's a theoretical physicist at Princeton, came up with this idea. He wrote this article in this famous four-page letter in Physics Letters B. He basically made this proposal. He sketched out a formula that roughly described how to calculate this sort of very chaotic kind of surface that would maybe help with quantum gravity. It was called the Liouville field. And it basically took 40 years for them to make, as one guy said, a French mathematician, Vincent Vargas, said, it took us 40 years in math to make sense of four pages. And so there was a group who put out three major papers that basically proved this 2D version of quantum gravity and showed that this particular thing that Polyakov had suggested really does actually work. However, the reason that it does not make the top five, and honestly, this probably could have made the top five. My justification is that it's 2D gravity. As amazing a mathematical result as that is, we don't live in a world of two-dimensional gravity. You know, so while it's phenomenally amazing and has some potential, I think it opens the door to some future work, but it doesn't, in its current form, describe the real world.
So yeah, you gave a quote there, which I should say was taken from Quanta, and we'll put a link to that Quanta article by Charlie Wood on the podcast page. But let me ask you, okay, so it hasn't made the list, so we don't want to talk about it in too much detail, but it hasn't made the list because you say it's a 2D version of quantum gravity. You know, the headline here in Quanta is mathematicians prove 2D version of quantum gravity really works. You know, if it had been a 3D version of quantum gravity that really works, it sounds like it definitely would have made your list. My question is maybe more of a philosophical one, which is, what does it mean to say that this model really works? You know, does that mean it actually describes anything that's out there in the physical world? Or is it just that as a mathematical model, I don't know, it hangs together really nicely? You know, what does really works mean here?
That's a very good question. And that's a particularly good thing to ask because this is, I suppose, ostensibly a physics podcast and a physics list. So in this particular case, what it means is that the theory that Polyakov had proposed in 1981 is mathematically self-consistent. And so it doesn't have any major mathematical errors in it. There's no experimental evidence or anything for this.
Okay, so good for them.
I'm going to say one last thing about that is that, again, I don't want to overshadow how immense an achievement that is. I think that is a tremendous achievement, and it's an important step on the road to a full theory of quantum gravity. I think it's tying it to that physical reality that is so crucial that, you know, is needed. If we're talking about physics, we need that.
Well, now on to the next honorable mention that is very much rooted in the real world.
One honorable mention. There was a group that managed to create a brain-computer interface that restored speech in a paralyzed man. And this is a group out of the University of California, San Francisco. And it's basically a speech neuroprosthesis. The guy can now, after receiving this, can communicate in actual sentences. And what they did was they basically translated his brain signals directly into words on a screen. I have a former student who got his PhD at Dartmouth and does similar work to this in the sense that he does neuroimaging and stuff like that. Some of the work I do on consciousness, I worked with a number of neuroscientists and we, you know, have looked at sort of similar things and trying to understand how to translate what's going on in the brain into reality and words and all that kind of stuff. And so it's quite an amazing feat that they were able to do this. But there have been incremental steps towards this in the past. So it's still amazing, and it really offers a tremendous possibility for helping people who have lost their ability to speak. I do also think it maybe takes us a step closer to being able to read the brain a little bit. I mean, that's the sort of the goal, is we want to be able to get to the point where we can figure out exactly what the brain is doing. And, you know, maybe, I mean, the scary thing is that, you know, eventually we might get to the point where we could read people's thoughts, but before people get freaked out and think that, you know, the government is going to start spying on them or something like that, we already have this ability. fMRI studies, we know that there are certain parts of the brain that when they light up, we know that they correspond to some particular class of thought that's going through your head, right? I mean, we know that. And we know that brain surgeries and things, you know, usually the people are awake when they do it. And we know, well, if we prod this portion of the brain, you can maybe smell coconuts. And if we prod this portion, maybe you'll smell something else, right? We sort of know these things. We've gotten the rough outline of this. What's impressive about this result is that we can get specific words out of it.
It is a fantastic result. Yeah, great hope for the future for actually practically helping people. A bit of a cheeky question here, but I'm sure you can answer it, because we're going to put up a link to an article about it in Physics World. And you've just mentioned that one of your students sort of eventually went off and worked in this area. It's not exactly clear to me why this is a physics story and not a kind of a neuroscience story, apart from the fact that everything boils down to physics at the end of the day. But because this is a foundational physics podcast, let's just find out why this is about physics.
Well, so of course, my first answer is exactly what you said. Everything is physics. It's all physics. You know, this is why physicists crash so many other fields. Like, the physics mentality, right, is about modeling and understanding how things work. It's a particular way of approaching the world. I think that's why this is. But if you really want to get down to it, what they're doing and what my former student was doing was they're working with electrodes. So in this particular case, the team used a high-density electrode array that basically recorded electrical activity in the brain. So it's all electrical stuff, which is physics. But, you know, like I said, everything is really just physics. I mean, come on, physicists run Wall Street, so, you know.
So Ian seems to have snuck in a neuroscience story as an honourable mention, even if he does claim that it's all physics. Maybe he's convinced you, I don't know. There is one more honourable mention to come that didn't make Ian's top five, but I think it should have done, because if that doesn't count as foundational physics and a foundational physics advance, then, you know, I don't know what does. And so we will be getting into it in some detail on the next episode. And we'll also begin the actual top five countdown. Links to more information about all the stories we have mentioned so far are on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast. Thank you again to Ian Durham for joining me today. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch and argue with either of us, please choose to argue with Ian rather than me. You'll find me on Twitter at FQXI and Ian at Quantum Moxie. We're also on Facebook and Instagram as FQXI Physics. Till then, I've been Zia Morali. Right, I'm off to exchange some Pomeranians.